morning. So, welcome to the last lecture. So let me briefly recapitulate what we have done yesterday. So we have started discussing relativistic field theories. So really, we now have the physical entity is the field phi, which is a function of T and X. You can think about T and X as a label or the field. It really denotes, you know, when and where we are talking about the field. So we just take a point in the space-time, and then we consider various fields in that point of the space-time. And of course, if I say relativistic, that you require that these fields transform nicely under Lorentz transformations. So in particular, for example, the scalar field will not transform at all, but then you can have vector fields, your Maxwell field, that will transform as a vector under Lorentz transformation. Then you will have a spinner field, Dirac field, it will transform as a spinner under Lorentz transformation. Then you will have the gravitational field, the metric G mu nu, and it will transform as a tensor under transformation. Okay, so anyway, so here is the action. You now integrate over space and time, so d4x over some space-time domain omega. And everything proceeds exactly the same way as we did for the particles. So now, you know, if you require that the action be stationary, and so you vary with respect to these fields, then you arrive at, you know, these beautiful Euler-Lagrange equations, which are precisely what you had for the particle. If I just replace phi with q, I would have dl over dq. And then, of course, in that case, the only label is the time. So I will have d over dt and q dot here. But otherwise, it's exactly the same. Right? So super simple. So now we also seen that, you know, we can formulate the Donnerthes theorem. And again, the formula for the Donnerthes theorem is very much very similar to what happens for the particle. In particular, the variations with respect to space-time coordinates had, you know, this T mu nu part, which was which I called the canonical energy momentum tensor, and then there was the other part. But you know, this is a very very important object in the field theory, in gravity, everywhere. So let me just stress, you know, this thing here, and you know, this T mu nu is conserved in this sense that, you know, d mu T mu nu equals to zero. And that all comes from the fact that your theory is actually invariant under space-time translations. So you derive that this is your conserved current, in fact, four conserved currents. So you take nu equals 1, 0, 1, 2, 3, and that gives you four conserved currents. And you derive that because of the invariance under the space-time translation. And of course, you know, because you have four conservation laws, you have four currents, you can construct the corresponding four conserved charges. And they are simply given over here by this formula, where you integrate over some three-dimensional surface in your space-time, sigma. And your integration better be independent on at which time you take the slice, so you can integrate over this guy here, or you can integrate over later time, or whatever. All these integrals, in principle, give you the same conserved charge as long as there's no flux through the boundary. Okay, and so in that case, really, these charges are conserved. So whatever you calculate here is whatever you calculate there, whatever you calculate there. And you can also start deforming the surfaces, so I don't need to start drawing them, you know, in later time, but I can just draw it here, and still it will be the same charge over there. Of course, the meaning of these charges for T mu nu is just the conserved energy and conserved momentum. Yes?
Sorry for asking this question again, but when you say deforming the surface of the hypersurface, how exactly do you do that? Because in special relativity, you don't have a general class of Diffeomorphisms.
Right. So here I am maybe, yeah. So yeah, I'm talking about general relativity. The same formula will apply anywhere you want. But Yeah, you can think about deforming your surface as a coordinate transformation, but you can also think about it like I'm doing a physical change of your surface, right? So I can really, you know, consider this surface and consider that surface. Of course, in principle, I can mimic this by doing a coordinate transformation, but at the same time, it could be a physical change of the surface. And so whatever the surface here is, as long as there is no flux through the boundary, the integral will be the same. That's maybe a better answer. All right, so we have this amazing team you knew, but the canonical team you knew, as given by this formula over here, it is certainly conserved on shell, but it may not have additional nice properties you would require from this team you knew. And so one nice property which you won't typically have is that the team you knew is symmetric. If it is not symmetric, there are some, you know, rotations. You haven't removed some internal rotations from your description and stuff like that. And so you know, it's the symmetric team you knew which is much nicer. Okay, so that's one thing. For the electromagnetic field, you would like your team you knew to be gauge invariant. Right, so if I change a mu to a mu plus d mu of lambda, then better my t mu nu remains the same. Again, you will find that this canonical t mu nu is not gauge invariant. Right, and you can fix that. You can make it gauge invariant, and then you will recover your beautiful formula, which you have in your homework. But this t mu nu, canonical one, will not be gauge invariant. It is not symmetric for electromagnetic field. It is not gauge invariant. And also, it may not be traceless. And because you know that Maxwell theory in four dimensions is a conformal field theory, your team you knew can be made traceless. Okay, very good. So we can upgrade this thing, and so people then call these things various names. For us, it's just, you know, upgraded team you knew or whatever. Yes.
The upgraded symmetric one gauge invariant.
It need not be, right? It depends. But here I'm just saying the upgraded one will be the symmetric one. So in the electromagnetism, you can cure everything in one go. And you know, you just do one iteration. You start with team unique canonical, then you add some, you know, super potential to that. And then in the end, everything is gauge invariant, symmetric, and traceless. Okay, so you can do it in one way, in one go. But typically, you know, you proceed in steps, right? So you start with team unique canonical, you see it's not symmetric. So you add some super potential to make it symmetric. Well, it's now symmetric, but it may still not be gauge invariant. So you think about another super potential, how to make it gauge invariant, and so on. Yes?
Is it possible that we have a theory that is like bad behavior and we cannot construct a symmetric energy tensor? What are like the sufficient conditions?
I have no idea, but certainly what is true is that if your theory is invariant with respect to Lorentz transformations, so far what we required was the invariance with respect to space-time translation, okay? Just, you know, moving things along x and t and whatever. But if you also require, you know, nice properties with respect to Lorentz transformations, so if your theory is Lorentz invariant, if it's a relativistic field theory, then there's always, you can always construct this superpotential, which makes this symmetric. Okay, so you know, that's a sufficient condition. If your theory is Lorentz invariant, you know how to do that. You know how to transform, construct a symmetric team mu. Okay. Another way how to construct this symmetric team mu is the GR way. So in general relativity, you just vary your action with respect to the metric, and because metric is symmetric, you always get a symmetric tensor, okay? And so and that will be also conserved. So there's always way how to do that in general relativity. Okay, so let me just finally mention here is that, of course, we are talking about relativistic field theories, so we better have nice behavior under Lorentz transformations. So then we can have also, you know, I wouldn't call that invariance, but nice transformation. This is really badly under. Why I don't write anything. Lorentz transformations. Okay, so if your theory behaves nicely under the Lorentz transformations, which should be the case of any relativistic field theory, then you can also construct another tensor, which is called, you know, spin tensor or angular momentum tensor, which will be also conserved. Then conserved angular momentum tensor. And the formula for that one is just, I don't know, let's call it M. And then this M, mu, rho, and sigma. So now it's an object which has three indices. And just given by 2 times T mu, rho, x sigma. Okay, so this is your angular momentum tensor. It is again conserved, d mu m mu rho sigma equals to 0. Okay, so what you see on the right hand side is the energy momentum tensor times the coordinate, and then there's an antisymmetrization between rho and sigma. So the object here is antisymmetric in rho and sigma. So in principle, it has many components, right? So you have 4 components here, and then you have 6 components here because it's antisymmetric here. So it's 24 components for this object here, okay? And it is conserved in this sense. And so correspondingly, you can also construct the conserved charges, right? So then we get 6 conserved charges. So we sum over this. So we have 6 currents. 6 currents. And so we have the corresponding 6 conserved charges. And of course, you get them by your favorite formula. So call them L rho sigma integral, same formula like that. So over some 3D surface, and then M mu rho sigma d sigma mu. Okay, so this is how you would construct the corresponding charges. Again, I'm summing over this index here. I'm leaving these things here. We have 6 currents, 6 conserved charges. Yes?
Sorry, the definition of m mu rho sigma is like t mu rho, and then it's x like your coordinate.
Yeah. So, okay, very good. Thanks for asking. So, this is a simplified formula. So, this simplified formula already uses the symmetric t mu nu. Symmetric t mu nu. If you don't use the symmetric one, there will be again an additional path which will correspond to internal spin of your field, but you can absorb that in your t mu nu. So basically, you know, you can absorb. So there will be other term here. So, you know, in some sense, while you're talking about conservation of angular momentum, right? And the conservation of angular momentum will be like, you know, the internal angular momentum plus the external angular momentum. So now this formula here, already the internal one was absorbed in the t mu nu, and so only the external angular momentum is actually remains. Yes?
Is x one of your indices, or is it like bigger and the rho and the sigma?
So this guy is just x mu is the coordinate.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Coordinate. So it's t, x, y, z.
In the brackets, does that?
Okay. And so this bracket here, so what I'm doing is, I should have t mu rho sigma minus t mu. What am I doing? T
mu rho x sigma minus p mu sigma x rho.
This is what I mean by that. Okay, so this guy is just an anti-symmetrization.
Okay, and the sigma is like the index of the x?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
So I take t, x0 is t, x1 is x, and so on.
Thanks.
Right? So this is what I mean by that. Yeah, please, if something is not clear, ask. Okay? So anyway, so this is the formula where we absorb internal spin. Absorb internal spin in T medium. And so really this is only the external spin, which is external angular momentum. Yes?
What do you mean by internal versus external?
Okay, so for example, you have gyroscope or something like that. Right, and that gyroscope has an internal angular momentum, which is precisely the spin of the rotating thing, right? But then the whole thing can rotate around the sun, right, and has an additional angular momentum, right? So then, of course, if you are asking, only the total angular momentum will be conserved, typically. So it's the spin, internal spin, plus this angular momentum, which is conserved, right? So what I have done here is that I said, well, basically, I absorbed the internal spin into this guy, making it symmetric, and then all I have left is just this angular momentum, which contains everything, sort of, right? So this is like the total angular momentum now. Okay, that's probably making one. Well, that's the idea, okay? Very good. So we have six conserved charges. Now, can you tell me what these could be? Right, so we have invariance under Lorentz transformation. Lorentz transformations have six components. They have the boosts, and they have the rotations. Right, three boosts and three rotations. So then there should be corresponding six charges. Do you know what these conserved charges are? Angular momentum. So that will be. Because I have invariance with respect to rotation, so I will have conserved angular momentum.
What about linear momentum for the boosts, the conserved momentum, the conservation of momentum?
Something like that, exactly.
Is it not that?
Yeah, it's almost that, yes. So very good. So these correspond to three angular momenta. I think what you said is right. And then three. Okay, I'll use your words. Linear momenta. For center of mass. So you know that if you have an isolated system, and it moves somewhere in the spacetime, the center of mass will just move. The momentum of the center of mass will be conserved. Okay, it will just move somewhere, and the total momentum of the system will be conserved. And so that's precisely what you get from invariance with respect to boost. Okay, so what is also funny is, well, if you look at these things here, because there's this x sigma here, right? So again, if I take x0, that's t. Okay, so this thing here, this object here, contains explicitly the time coordinate. Okay, so this guy here, may also contain explicitly the time coordinate. Right, so you have conserved charges which are now time dependent. Okay, these are precisely those things. If you study these things here, so there will be an explicit time dependence of these conserved charges, and it's interesting. So whatever I have been telling you is that you typically have. If you have conserved quantities, they must be time independent. You can just define them by the Poisson bracket is the Hamiltonian is equal to zero. So that's not true for these conserved charges. You have to have the explicit time dependent. So, these things here, really, so d l rho sigma dt very schematically, this will be zero. But that's not just l rho sigma
is the Hamiltonian, but you also need dl rho sigma divided by dt. So you need this term because they are explicitly time dependent. So the whole thing will be conserved in time. Well, this is very schematic, right? But anyway, so the whole thing will be conserved, but you need because they are explicitly time dependent. It's not true that the Poisson bracket with the Hamiltonian would be zero, but rather this plus that is zero. Okay, there's some more details in the study text if you want.
Find out exactly is strictly time dependent. Kind of missed something.
Okay, so what I'm saying here is so if you look at how this looks like, right, it has these x's explicitly there, right? It's an x sigma and x rho. But of course, if I take a sigma equal to zero, then there will be time. So I will have t mu rho t, and then I will have t mu t and something, right? So this, you know, can explicitly depend on time, and of course it propagates into these guys.
Not all the six conserved charges depend on time then. It depends on what six.
So these will not, because you get these by considering the spatial rotations, and so there won't be any time. So these are time independent. But the other three, actually, you know, whatever you construct from here, they will be explicitly time dependent. Okay.
And so you don't exactly derive how when you put sigma to equal to zero, which is intuitively understandable, but you're not going to derive why these correspond to angular momenta and the ones that have sigma or rho equal to zero.
I wasn't planning to. I can do it if you want. So yeah. So it's in the study text if you are interested. Just you know, look at that. But I wasn't going to show that. But you know, intuitively, this thing here, you know, if I have, for example, T00, that's like the energy density times the length, energy times length is something like connected with the angular moment, right? All right, so that's what I wanted to discuss generally about relativistic field theories. So now let me give you some examples in the remaining time, just to have something concrete. So now, examples for the rest of the lecture. And of course, everybody starts with a scalar field. So let me also start with a scalar field, although, you know, it's very stupid example, right? But anyway, so you will do it in your quantum field theory. One, you will quantize scalar field. Well, do nothing else than that. So let's just write down what the action is for scalar field. So of course now we have Higgs, and so it is useful. Moreover, you know, scalar field is typically, you know, used if you want to describe inflation of early universe and stuff like that. It's always present in the string theory spectrum. So you have lots of scalar fields there. So why not to discuss the scalar field? And so the action is super simple. So what you just write down here, well, you need to write a kinetic term for the scalar field. A kinetic term typically contains some derivative of the scalar field. And so the only covariant derivative, which is Lorentz invariant, you can do, so basically like q dot square, is you write d mu phi, d mu phi. Okay, so that's your kinetic term, which is, yeah, it's like q dot square. And then, of course, you can have a potential term as well, so minus v of phi, so that's your action. Yes?
I feel like I should know this, but how come it's all negative?
How come?
How come it's negative?
Oh, very good. Good. That's good. So very good. So what is this thing here, right? This thing here is just eta mu nu d mu phi d nu phi. You happy with this? OK. So now this eta mu nu has strange signs, right? If you take eta 0, 0, it has a minus sign.
Okay, so beware, right? So maybe
convention at some point, or
yeah, of course. No. I'm using still the same convention, but in your quantum field theory, you will be using the opposite convention. So for me, eta 0, 0. So this guy is for me is -1, +1, +1, +1, right? But in quantum field theory, you'll probably see the other convention. You will see +1, -1, -1, -1, right? So it's I've seen so many conventions, and so for example, when that was the worst convention ever. So when Arton Zwieback was giving a string theory course, like, so he was like really using, this convention -++. So I was very happy about that. But in the end, he wrote the Minkowski metric as -eta μ dx μ dx nu. Okay, so he was using the right convention for this guy, but then just to save the day, he put a minus here. Okay, it's also a convention. Okay. So anyway, so this is an eta mu nu d mu d nu phi, right? So if I want to calculate really what the kinetic energy is, which is intuitively connected with the time derivative, right? So then I put just mu equal to 0 and nu equal to 0 and eta mu nu. So then I will pick up a minus sign from this eta mu nu, and I will have dt phi, right? But this minus sign will cancel that minus sign. I will have +1/2 dt phi square. So the kinetic term actually has a plus here. So it is fine. Right? Okay, very good. So the kinetic term has the plus sign here. But then, of course, if you look at the spatial part here has a plus instead of minus. So now if I have di phi, there will be a plus. Di phi. Aha. But there's an overall minus here. So actually the spatial derivatives come with a minus sign. Okay. So that sort of tells you, and people hand wave, that actually, the variations of the field in space should be more counted as a potential energy because they come with a minus sign. Whereas the variations of phi in this respect to time, they come as a kinetic energy. So in some sense, you would say that there's a kinetic term is this one here, which has the right sign, and then the potential term is this one plus that one. Okay? Sometimes people say that. Yes.
So the -1/2, the negative in front of the kinetic term, could have been +1/2.
So very good. So in my convention there is a -1/2. In you will see in quantum field theory convention you will see +1/2.
And then the metric convention will cancel it out. But
what I'm saying
is, what if it was negative kinetic term?
Oh, then. Okay, so then you would have some kind of instabilities. You would have, there's many examples where you have negative mass or negative kinetic term or scalar fields and stuff like that, and they're typically connected to some kind of instability, stachyonic fields and stuff like that.
Why would that contribute to negative mass? It's not.
Not negative mass. Imaginary mass, or something like that. That's better. Okay, I'll give you an example. Okay, so very good. So we have the scalar field. We can play with interpretation of kinetic energy and potential energy or whatever. So then, that's our Lagrangian here. So that's our L. And then we're going to use our beautiful formula for the Lagrange equation to write down what the equation of motion for the scalar field is. Okay, very good. So the first term is dl over d phi. So now I understand this L as a function of phi and d mu phi. Right? So the only phi without the derivative is here. So it's minus dv over d phi. Okay. And then it's minus d mu. And then I have to calculate dl over d mu phi. So the d mu phi is over here. If I differentiate this one term here, another term here, so I will get twice. It's minus d mu phi.
and that's it, and that's equal to zero. So in other words, what you are getting is a box equation, d mu phi. By the way, this is nothing else, just the box which we introduced before, the wave thing, and then minus. And I can write down the total derivative because v depends only on phi. So dv over d phi is better, equals to zero. So that's your equation of motion for the scalar field. And then, of course, you know, during inflation, you play with whatever the potential is right potential to give you the right kind of inflation you like, and so on. But again, in your field theory course, you will just use the simplest potential, which is just, you know, giving mass to the scalar field. So in that case, so simplest example, apart from having just the kinetic term and setting the potential equal to zero, is that, you know, just to add mass to the scalar field. And then this is done by that. So you just consider potential, which is 1/2 m squared phi squared. Think about harmonic oscillator. That's what we are writing here, basically. Just adding harmonic oscillator term over there. In which case, of course, I differentiate it y, well, d phi, I get a phi here, n squared phi. And so your equation of motion is just d squared minus m squared times phi equals to zero. And that's your Klein-Gordon equation. Okay, and so you will play with this in your field theory course. By the way, I give you a problem in your interviews, I think, to derive the canonical energy momentum tensor here. I just give you the answer, and you can play with that, how it is derived. I'm not giving you the answer for the interview. You'll just find that it's 8 mu nu times the original Lagrangian plus d mu phi d nu phi. Okay? So this is the answer for the question for your interview, I think.
How would that mu mu?
Sorry?
Mu nu.
Mu nu. Sorry. So that comes from that formula there. You see, it's immediate, right? So we have d mu nu eta mu nu l as the first term, and the second term is very simple. Questions? Well, this was the simplest example. As I say, you know, the scalar fields are important. Probably, if you want to study inflation, then you will put much more complicated potential here. You can start putting many more scalar fields. You can have 1,000 scalar fields driving your inflation and so on. Okay, so now real physics. Okay, yes.
Is there any way to cover Lorentz transformation by observing physics quantum?
Say it again, if it's what?
Is there any way to recover Lorentz transformation by observing?
By having a charge. Well, you know that, well, again, so think about the geometrical picture in the phase space, right? So you know that any phase space function generates a flow in the phase space, right? Right? So I just put a Poisson bracket, I leave one slot open, put that function there, and then generates a flow corresponding to the thing, right? So then what happens if I put a Hamiltonian there? Well, the Hamiltonian will generate a time translation, right? That's what you call time. The corresponding flow corresponds to time translation. If I put any other charge there, it will correspond to the motion in that phase space. So very good. So now I put this, you know, in the Poisson bracket, and better generates rotations or something like that.
If it has a time dependence.
Oh, if there is a time dependence. Well, so there is a time dependence. Then you have to. Okay, very good. So then you have to go beyond phase space. You have to go to the contact space, where the time is another coordinate in that phase space. So
So basically, you have to have 2n plus 1 dimensional phase space where you include time as one of the coordinates.
Still, we can think the charges as a generator of time.
Yeah, definitely. All right, so now let's do real physics. And the real physics is, of course, Maxwell's theory. So it's our favorite one. I'll just write down again. Well, you will play with this in your homework. So now the action for Maxwell theory or classical electrodynamics. Let's put it this way. Okay, and so the action will be function of two things. So in classical electrodynamics, you treat the electromagnetic field as field, so described by the vector potential A mu. But you also treat your electrons or your matter as actually particles. And so your action will be function of the vector potential, but also of the trajectory of the electrons and whatever. Right? And so the action is quite simple. So there's some plus minuses, and there's some 16 pi's and whatever. There's some electric charges moving around. I'm never sure what the convention is, but you better fix it in your homework, okay? So that you get the right equations. So first, we have to put the action for the electromagnetic field, okay? So we just want whatever governs the electric field if it were on its own, okay? So the action will be, so it's a field theory, so it is d4x, right? And so then you are thinking, well, I want something which is Lorentz covariant, but also I want something which is gauge invariant. So better, I don't have any terms as a mu explicitly, better I hide everything in f mu nu, okay? So then you may think, okay, so I have f mu nu at my disposal, so can I construct some Lorentz invariant out of f mu nu? So one thing, the simplest thing which you might think about is I just take f mu mu. Okay, so I will just take f mu nu, and I will contract it as eta mu nu. Does this work?
It's first order.
Okay.
And it's symmetric and symmetric, that's zero?
Uh-huh, very good. So this will not work, right? So this would be a good guess. It depends on a mu. In fact, it depends on the derivatives of a mu, the first derivatives of a mu. So that's what you want from the action. You want that it depends on a mu and derivatives of a mu at most. So that would be fine. It is gauge invariant, but it is zero. It doesn't help you much. So you know, the simplest thing which you can actually write down is that you write down f mu nu. You write two f mu nu's and you contract them together. And so that's the action for electromagnetic field action. So we have the field itself. Well, then we better have some electrons. So the electrons will be described by, you know, having some mass and then some charge. But we already know that, you know, we know what would be the action for a free particle. So that's just the square root of eta mu nu, u mu, u nu, d tau, right? So let's just use that. You know, if the electrons were free, well, let me just write one electron, but we can have many more, right? So that would be a mass, and then d lambda, and whatever we know already, eta mu nu, dx mu, d lambda, dx nu, d lambda. So that will be one electron. So we can sum over many if you want. So then you would have sum over, yeah. Or you could have protons as well. So there will be different masses. So you will have sum over mi and these things here. D lambda I. Okay. And then, of course, so now we have three electrons, which are happily, you know, traveling through space-time, know nothing about the electromagnetic field. Then you have free electromagnetic field, knows nothing about the electrons. But in the end, you better want that the electrons do interact with your electromagnetic field. And so you need an interaction term. And so the interaction term can be written as such. So then this is, you know, the electric charge here coming into play. And then you have d lambda, d pi mu over d lambda, a mu of y. Okay, so that's the interaction term. And the meaning of this interaction term is very simple. So if you look at this, so it's dy mu over d lambda is the four velocity of the electron. Okay. Now you have charge times four velocity. Okay, what is that?
Current.
Current. Very good. So this thing here, you can think about like a j mu for the electron. Four current for the electron. And so then what is this interaction term really telling you is that, well, the four current interacts with your vector potential A mu. Okay? So there's nothing else you can write down, right? I have A mu and I have J mu, which describes my thing, and this is the only thing I can write down. A mu, J mu. That's what we are writing down here. Yes?
D X mu D lambda in the electron term, should that be a Y?
Say it again.
Action.
Ah, yes. Thank you. So many mistakes. I'm so sorry. Dy mu. So electrons always y, okay? We want to distinguish it from the space-time coordinate x, right? So that should be dy mu d lambda, dy mu d lambda. Many more mistakes. Yes?
The interaction term is not Gates invariant.
Aha. Is it? Or is it not?
It depends in A mu, and A mu is Gates. It really is dependent in the Gates. So.
Aha. Uh-huh. So did I just violate what I said that we want Gage invariant action? What do you think? This is a very good observation. So is this thing here? Is it Gage invariant or not? That's the question. Doesn't seem so, right? If I go from a mu to a mu plus d mu of lambda, well, it seems like, well, I have my original a mu j mu. So I have a mu j mu now goes to a mu plus j mu d mu of lambda, right? So this is what I had. That's fine. But this thing here seems like I don't want that, right? I can choose whatever the lambda I want, and you know this spoils my.
By plus give you two terms that are equal to zero, I think.
Because.
E mu j mu is zero.
Charge.
Aha! Very good. So what you can do is that of course it's an action, so you can integrate by parts by picking some boundary terms, right? So I can actually write this as d mu of j mu lambda, and then minus. D mu j mu times lambda, right? And then, of course, the first term will just give me, so this thing here will give me the boundary term. And this thing here, if the current is conserved, is zero. Okay? So in that case, the boundary term you just throw away as always. If your current is conserved, it better be, then your action is Gage invariant. Okay. So you want basically conservation of the current part of your thing so that you know you can write terms like this. Okay. Very good.
What is the only interaction term that you can write? Like you can write something looks like
well, you can something like that. Okay, give me an example, right? Let's try to write something.
J mu, J
Very good. So there is another proposal for interaction. Okay, it's linear in A. That's fine. It's not quadratic in J, which looks suspicious. But nevertheless, can we write something like this? Yes.
You need to correct the unit for the action.
You could put some constants out for
no. Yeah. Well, apart from units or whatever, can you write this?
Interaction is still zero.
Still zero, right? Because this guy here is the same thing, right? It's the same J here, so this guy is symmetric in mu and nu, right? If I swap these two, nothing changes. So then this symmetric dimension is zero, right? So this one wouldn't give us. Yes.
What if we had like J mu A nu F mu?
Say that again. J nu.
J mu. Or one of them is going to be mu, one of them is going to be mu, and then the A mu, I guess, F mu nu. No, not J, not two J's.
Just one J.
Yeah, just one J.
A nu.
A mu.
No, A. Oh, I see. A mu.
Just replace one of the J's.
Yeah.
F mu nu. Oh, very good. Well, this wouldn't be automatically zero. That's right. But you know, first of all, it wouldn't be gauge invariant. Second, well, it might be. But anyway, we would need to check. But second of all, well, what you typically want is a linear kind of interaction, right? So here, this kind of interaction, of course, is possible, probably. But you know, you are interacting your electron, but now the electron interacts like quadratically with your gauge field, right? Which is okay. It would be a nonlinear interaction, and maybe you know one would have to. So this is the simplest thing you can write down, which is linear in the field, linear in the whatever. So for big interactions, this will be fine. If you know, maybe you can write something like that. Okay, that's very good. So I'll ask you about that in the interview.
Okay, so two questions. Two of them are both actually fairly maybe stupid. So when you constructed the action out of the blue, just considering gauge invariant and Lorentz covariants. And that's all well and good, but that's no proof. That's just something just made out of thin air.
Sounds good. Yeah, I'm happy with that.
So what if we wanted to say, okay, I want to give this to a computer. I want to say, okay, these are my laws. Just make me the action. Put a constraint in there to just say, okay, find the simplest thing you can find. So
I don't know what you are driving at. So of course, you know, so this is the action, and you can motivate this action very well, right? So you can say, I want gauge invariance, I want something which depends on dA, the kinetic term. So you know, anyway, so this is the simplest thing you can write down, which is very, very intuitive. So then you can use this as a starting point of your theory. Right, so your theory starts with an action. Just write down the action, and then you look at the consequences of the theory. Right. So of course, you derive the equations of motion. You do some experiments and whatever, and then you see does this actually correspond to what you see or not. Right. But.
Okay. Gonna skip that one. So the next question is that I think this is a quote that I think I'm. Basically 5 minutes, and 5 minutes ago, you said that d mu, j mu, lambda is a boundary term, which of course it is, and it is a waste. So we waste it, we say it doesn't matter. What was the reason that it...
So this is a boundary term, so you yeah. Typically put your boundary very, very far away.
Sure.
Typically, you are interested in the systems where there is no electrons very, very far away. Right? So typically, everything interesting happens...
Say lambda is infinity.
Well, you don't want gauge functions which are badly behaved on the boundary. Okay.
Also gauge freedom.
But you know, there's a gauge freedom, but you have to be very careful what really is the gauge freedom there. Right? And so you will see, well, you will not see, but it's actually something that was realized only recently, is that, well, you say, well, I can always do a mu to a mu plus d mu lambda, where lambda is anything. But that's not true if you have boundary, and we have boundary. Otherwise, our variational principle is not well defined. And so what you require is that your gauge function actually vanishes on the boundary.
If it does not, then actually it corresponds to true degrees of freedom, and it's not a gauge function anymore. It's actually a true degree of freedom which you are introducing into your system. So if your lambda does not vanish, you know, on the boundary, then you are screwed up, and you are considering a system where you have some propagating degrees of freedom on the boundary. So that's the answer, basically. So what you want typically is that lambda vanishes on the boundary. So as you go far away, it just goes dies off, and this is a true gauge transformation, and it's just a, you know, freedom in your description. If it does not vanish at the boundary, then you are talking about system with more degrees of freedom, and you know that you have propagating degrees of freedom. It's a beautiful example of this in general relativity, where you see, think, well, I can change coordinates to anything I want, but you know, once you, for example, start changing phi by thing, you are starting introducing some cosmic strings into your space-time or Meissner strings and stuff like that. And these are physical objects which carry angular momentum and carry energy and stuff like that. So really, you know, once you start doing weird gauge transformations which do not vanish, which do not die off at infinity nicely, then you are completely changing your system. It's a very good question.
My question is about sort of the extremum of the action that you wrote down. So in general, in this case, it's because it's we know Maxwell's equations, we can sort of reconstruct them from the action.
Yes.
In general, if you have some number of fields and some number of things that couple to that fields, and you write some number of terms in your actions, it is not necessarily the case that you can simultaneously optimize all of the terms of the action. That which means you might not have a solution to your physical system in some sense.
Oh, is that true? I don't know. So anyway, so the prescription is always vary this with respect to the fields you have, right? And then you get some and in the variations of a mu will be independent, the variations of y nu, right? And so requiring the action principle, whatever that requires, that I set this equal to zero, that's what I have to do. Right? I don't think there's any contradiction can arise. Right? So you always have to vary with respect to everything. So you vary with respect to that, you vary with respect to that, and then you get your equations of motion, and there cannot be any contradiction. We can maybe talk about what you mean. Yes?
Is charge conservation an extra requirement at this point, or it follows from
the... Aha. What do you think? It's very unclear, right? So if the charge is conserved, and this is the gauge invariant term, I can write it down. I can write this term down anyway if I don't care about the gauge invariants, right? But it's very puzzling, right? What is also puzzling about this action is that, of course, we are cheating here, right? What we want to derive is Maxwell equations, right? We have two sets of Maxwell equations. You have the Maxwell equations, which look like this. And we have the second set of equations, which look like that. Okay. We also have the interaction of electrons with electromagnetic field, which will be the Lorentz force. All right. So these are the equations which better follow from this action. So you will check in your homework. So do these really follow from your action? What do you think? Any ideas, anybody? What about this one?
Sorry?
So I wrote down the action. We better be able to derive all equations of motion which we know for Maxwell's theory are true, right? So that consists of Maxwell equations. So there's this Maxwell equation, and there's that Maxwell equation. And we also have Lorentz force law between the electrons and the force. So the question is, do all three equations here, as I wrote them down, really follow from varying this action?
We should have an extra source term if we don't require charge conservation at the action level.
A source term.
If I do a gauge transformation in A, I do not require the charge conserved, then I have to create that extra term and to contribute to one of the equations.
I see what you are saying. Okay, let's leave that term for the moment. Okay. So, okay, does this equation follow from this action? What do you think? You will see it in your homework, right? Explicitly, but yes.
Yes, right? So I just vary this. That gives me the geodesic equation, but I also have that, and that gives me the Lorentz force. Sorry for that. Uh-oh. finally, I destroyed it. Okay. So that gives me this equation definitely follows from there. What about this equation here? Probably does, right? So this one is fine. What about that equation here?
It's the magnetic monopole assumption that doesn't fall. That equation is the magnetic monopole equation, right?
Yeah, divergence of B is equal to zero.
Uh-huh, yeah. And you can show that this equation is satisfied whenever I set f mu nu equal to d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. Okay, so this equation will be satisfied. And this is true, but that's my assumption, right? I don't treat this action as a function of f mu nu. I treat it as a function of a mu, right? So I'm already assuming this. So basically, this equation is already assumed. It does not follow from the action. It's already assumed. And it's actually very, very difficult to formulate the action where this wouldn't be assumed, and you could derive this equation. It's very, very complicated.
So another problem is that when we define f mu nu like this, and if someone says, okay, now I found the magnetic monopole in my experiments in the lab, and you just have to rewrite everything.
Exactly, because you cannot write this, and then, yeah. So then people do, you know, double potential thing. So they say that f mu nu is given by this, and f mu nu star is given by another vector potential b nu, or whatever, and then they can start playing with it. But it's quite difficult to incorporate all this thing here. Was there a question?
How many equations is that, the f mu nu rho?
So this thing here, so this is a complete anti-symmetrization. So then you are asking how many objects with three indices which are completely antisymmetric in three indices are there in four dimensions. So that's given by a combinatorial number 4/3. So there's four equations here. Okay? Four equations here, four equations here, four equations there. Okay, this is fun, isn't it? So okay, so you will derive all this in your homework. You will derive the team you knew for this theory in your homework. But, you know, that's the beautiful theory. I just wanted to stress one more thing, which we discussed with somebody in tutorial yesterday, I think. So let me just stress this. So conservation of charge. In Maxwell equation, so we have the first Maxwell equation here, which is d mu f mu nu equals to. So what I will be saying here is very trivial, but let me just stress that. So this is our Maxwell equation, d mu f mu nu minus 4 pi j nu, right? And so if you apply d nu on the whole thing, so now let's apply d nu on the whole thing, then we have d nu, d mu, f mu nu, it's minus 4 pi d nu, j nu. Okay? Oh, so far so good. So now what is the left hand side?
Zero.
It is zero, right? So it's again our favorite symmetric times antisymmetric. So this is zero identically.
Okay, this is kind of cheap. Because we already used d nu, j nu is equal to zero.
Where did we use it? Oh, no. Okay, sorry. I'm not talking about the action or anything like that. I'm talking about just the Maxwell equation. Okay, so this. Okay,
no, but we wrote the. We said, okay, if you
forget about action, okay, forget about action. No action at this point. It's just Maxwell equation. We know this is the Maxwell equation, right? So I agree. You know, the charge conservation is sort of, you know, doing strange things, right? But anyway, so once we have the Maxwell equation, which was experimentally well verified and so on, so this is definitely correct equation, right? Or maybe not. We shall see in 5 minutes that maybe not. So d nu, d mu, f mu nu is identically equal to zero. Okay? So what it means is that from here, the d nu, j nu equal to zero better be true as well. Otherwise, you cannot write down the Maxwell equation. Right? So this is, this equation is a consequence of the Maxwell equation. So this has to be true in order I am able to write down the Maxwell equation. So the charge conservation is a necessary requirement for this equation to make sense at all. So you can say this is basically like an integrability condition. Integrability condition. Or consistency equation for Maxwell equation to make sense at all. So without that, you can never find solutions of this equation. They will simply be inconsistent. Okay, we have done scalar field, we have done electrodynamics, let's do gravity, right? So the same thing we have done here applies to gravitational. So the corresponding Einstein equation here, so similarly in gravity, the Einstein equations are written as g mu nu equals to 8 pi g newton g mu nu. Okay. This is the Einstein tensor. It's some function of the metric and its first derivatives and second derivatives and so on. This is just the Newton gravitational constant. And this is the energy momentum tensor, which we sort of already know, the symmetric one. Okay, so we already know this guy, and we know that it is conserved. Okay. So now what you can do is that you can similarly to doing this thing here, you can write down the consistency condition for when this equation has a solution. Okay, consistency condition is that you do some kind of derivative on this Einstein tensor. So you do now apply the derivative nabla mu. It's like a partial derivative, but slightly better. Okay? So you do nabla mu g mu nu equals to 8 pi g newton nabla mu g mu nu. Okay? So that's what we have done. So now when you will study some geometry with Lewis in 2 weeks or whatever, you will learn that this thing here is identically equal to zero. It's so-called Bianchi identity. Okay? This is equal to zero identically. So meaning, the g mu nu is some expression which contains metric, first derivatives of the metric, second derivatives of the metric. If I apply another derivative to it, you will find that it's equal to zero. Okay? All the terms cancel and you find zero. Okay, so what that means is that nabla mu g mu nu equals to zero is a necessary condition for your Einstein equation to write down. Okay. So this is a consistency condition. For your Einstein equations to make sense. So in other words, you can only couple to matter host t mu nu is conserved. This is like partial mu t mu nu equals to zero. But slightly better partial. Okay? But the matter actually has to, the conservation of t mu nu is a necessary requirement for you to be able to write down the Einstein equation. So similarly, the conservation of charge is a necessary condition for you to be able to write Maxwell equations. Okay? This is even more beautiful here than there. Why it's beautiful? Here. Here, we just require that the charge is conserved. Okay? So it's not an equation of motion for your electron. It's just that the electron has to move in such a way that its charge is conserved. Okay? Here, this is stronger. This thing here is actually an equation of motion for the matter. So this already tells you how the matter moves. Okay, so there is no any freedom whatsoever. So if you know the Einstein equation, the consistency equation for that equation already tells you how the matter moves. This is why Einstein theory is the most beautiful theory ever. In Maxwell theory, you need two sets of equations. You need equations of motion for the matter, and you need field equations for the field. Two types of equations. The Einstein equations contain both. This is the field equation for how the gravitational field evolves in the presence of matter. But this is an equation how the matter moves in the presence of gravitational field. So Einstein equations contain both information. This is so beautiful. Yes?
Have there ever been any successful reformulations of Maxwell's equations to make them look more like gravitational?
So certainly what you can do is that you can expand these equations for weak field, gravitational field, weak gravitational field, close to Minkowski. Space-time, it just has some small perturbations. And then you can show that this rewrites that.
But what about the other way?
Well, this will not work because this thing here is nonlinear. It's a nonlinear equation. So this is a nasty equation for the metric, okay? Whereas this one here is linear in F mu, in A mu, whatever. It's linear. So what you can do is that you can expand this, you can linearize this equation, you get back to that. But this is like a nonlinear version of that. But because of this nonlinearity, this equation is much more powerful.
You make this one nonlinear or no?
Yes, you can. That's my next step. Questions so far? Yes?
You said it, like in the flat space-time assumption, it reduces to electromagnetism? Like it's electromagnetism from the gravitational theory?
So, exactly, exactly.
Really?
Yeah. So. It's an electromagnetism for gravity. Yeah, for gravity. So of course now we are not talking about the electromagnetic field. We are talking about the gravitational field. But if you do linearization of this, you recover Maxwell type equation, basically that equation there, and you recover the Lorentz force. Okay, for gravity. So any matter will be subject to Lorentz force. Any matter will produce something like electromagnetic field. But now gravitational. Of course, now if you do Newtonian approximation, meaning your things are not only weak but also move slowly and so on, then you recover electrostatics or Poisson equation for gravity. You need to recover Newton, right? But so in the weak field you get Maxwell, and if you do moreover slow, non-relativistic approximation, you get back to Newton. Yes.
When you want to write the action for gravity, you won't have a term for particles separately. Everything is just one like Einstein-Hilbert term. But why if we want to go to a picture that we can look at the electrons as the excitations of the fields, then for the electrodynamic action, can we get rid of that geodesic term for electrons? Like everything just be written in.
So certainly.
Something like that, because it's like you're treating particles differently from fields. But
exactly, yeah. So what you can do here is that you can do, for example, scale electrodynamics, right? I can replace my particles, point particles, with a scalar field. So then I'll say my electrons are described by scalar field, and then you won't have geodesic equation. You will just have an equation of motion for scalar field. That's right. Yeah. Or you can do better. Scalar field does not carry any spin. We know that electrons have spin 1/2. You can put a Dirac field, right? Dirac field is something which describes spin 1/2. So then, you know, the right electro, you know, quantum electrodynamics starts basically from this action where you replace the point particle with the Dirac field. And you will do that in quantum theory too. All right, so yes.
If you do what you explained before about linearizing gravity, how can you get something similar to electromagnetism if the gauge symmetry of electromagnetism is U1, but the gauge symmetry in gravity is the diffeomorphism group, which is like much bigger? How do you match symmetries?
The answer is you do. No, that we would have to go into details here, right? But basically the statement is, yes, you can fix the gauge for gravity so that you sort of have like a Lorentz gauge for, you know, so here your Lorentz gauge would be something like this. Here, what you are doing is that you are setting the metric to flat space plus a perturbation. And then so this perturbation is, so this is something fixed. It's your Minkowski metric. This is your perturbation. And then you are setting the gauge, the Lorentz gauge for that equals to zero. So that's an analog of that gauge. And you can do that because of the diffeomorphism invariance. You can do this because you have a gauge symmetry for your A mu. You can do this because you have a gauge symmetry for the G mu nu. And so that's the gauge. And in this gauge, the equations here will reduce to Maxwell equations. You will see that in the relativity course. Yes?
I could sort of understand the correspondence between like charge, electric charge, and like gravitational charge in some sense.
Uh-huh.
If it reduces to electromagnetism, does that mean that there's some sort of gravitational magnetic field? Or
exactly. This is something called gravitomagnetic field. And it's precisely, you really get Lorentz force, right? So you know that if you have electrostatics, right, then you have electric fields or whatever. So now let's say I start something moving, right, or rotating. Let's say I start rotating a charged sphere, right? If you start rotating a charged sphere, what happens is that you create magnetic field around it, right? And so this magnetic field, if you shoot some electrons on that, it will experience the Lorentz force and it will start rotating with the sphere, for example. The same thing happens in gravity. In gravity, if I have a massive sphere, right, it will produce the Newtonian law. If I start rotating it, it will produce a gravitomagnetic field. If you shoot something at it, it will experience gravitomagnetic force, which is the Lorentz force, and it will start rotating with the stuff, for example. So it's exactly the same thing. So that's why you need to understand electromagnetism before you go to gravity, because it exists, you know, gravity knows everything about electromagnetism plus more, right? So everything you need to know about, yes.
Charges in gravity we have mass, but in electromagnetism we have plus or minus charges for the electric field. Does
yeah.
Make a difference in any
time? It definitely does, but let them well. it's simply given by the fact that you have spin two field. So for spin two field you have only like positive charges. I don't know. so spin two field, gravity is spin two field. If you have spin one, you can have positive and negative charges. If you have spin two, you basically can have only. So this is just the normal partial derivative because you are close to Minkowski, and this is a perturbation. So this covariant derivative will be a partial derivative plus something which depends on the gravitational field. We are treating the gravitational field weak, so this guy is already weak. So I can trade covariant derivative to partial derivative, and the rest is higher order.
So in space times where we have strong gravity, this condition will not work.
This will not work. So this is only for, well, you can generalize this, you know, when it comes to some curve space. But you know, here I was just trying to go from here to linearize this to go back to Minkowski, and I'm linearizing around Minkowski background here. So yeah.
Can we expect to write the action for gravity in some way similar to electrodynamics, like separate the field part and then particle part, and then expect that drive the same Einstein equations at some energy limit, like writing a geodesic equation and something like G mu nu and two action terms?
Okay. Let me write down the action for gravity. I didn't want to do that, but okay, let's do it. So for gravity, so you have tough time to do that. What you want is your basic field is the metric. Basic field is the metric. G mu nu, okay. That's your basic field. So now the question is, can I write down a Lagrangian, which would be a function of the metric and of its first derivative? Question is, can you do that? And you may try. You keep trying, you don't find anything. Then you ask your friend who is a mathematician, and he will tell you there is no such thing. Okay? So this thing does not exist. The reason why it does not exist is it has very physical meaning why it doesn't exist. The reason is the equivalence principle. The equivalence principle tells you that I can always locally mimic gravitational field with acceleration. Okay, so if I start accelerating, it's like I produce some gravitational field g. Okay, so that means that I can get rid of gravity by going to a freely falling frame. If you start freely falling, you are accelerating sort of downwards with the gravitational field. You don't feel any gravitational field. You can get rid of that. Okay, what it means is that you can always kill this term here by going to a freely falling frame. And so then you would have only action which depends on g, which does not give you anything. So that's why it doesn't exist. Okay. So this doesn't exist. So you go for the next best thing. Okay. And so what you have to do is that you have to include both the first derivative and the second derivative of the metric. Okay. So this is what you have to do. So this seems bad. Why it seems bad? We already know from our classical mechanics thing is that once we start including higher order derivatives, then we are starting producing higher order equations of motion. All right? So if you include two derivatives here, we expect fourth order equations of motion. Unless we are lucky and the dependence on this second derivative of g is through a total derivative, as we have seen in the first tutorial, right? So unless we are lucky, and this term is not there, then we are screwed up, and we have fourth order equations of motion. Okay, so then we ask a friend, what is the simplest scalar which we can write down out of the metric, its first derivative and the second derivative? And the friend tells you, okay, so the only object which contains first derivative, second and third derivative is the Riemann tensor. R alpha beta gamma delta, that's the Riemann. Okay. That's the only thing you have. There's nothing else, which contains g, dg, and d squared g. Well, this has bloody many two indices. I don't want these indices, I want the scalar. So you just contract the indices, you contract this guy with that guy using the metric, and you contract this guy with that guy. And what you get is the Ricci scalar. Okay, so that's the simplest thing you can construct out of this thing. So now you can check, and this Ricci scalar is indeed such that the dependence on the second derivative is only through the total derivative. Okay, so that does not give you fourth order equations of motion as you were worried, but it gives you second order equations of motion. And that gives you the Einstein equations. So your action, then for gravity, is S 1 over 16 pi g newton d4x. So now d4x is bad in gravity. What you also have to supply is the square root of the determinant of the metric. So you put a minus square root of that g, and then the Ricci scale. And that's your action for gravity. OK, Einstein-Hilbert action. And you're done.
our alphabetic gamma delta, like the Ricci or the Riemann tensor, is the only quantity you could write contain like with the
tensor. So here.
Yeah.
So what I've done here. So you know, you may ask your friend who's a mathematician, like what kind of object I can construct out of. What is the most general object I construct out of G, D, G, and D squared G? And they tell you there's only one such object. It's the Riemann tensor. It's a bloody beast. It's a tensor with four indices, alpha, beta, gamma, delta. Okay, so it's, of course, if you have a tensor with four indices, then it will transform under coordinate transformation as a tensor, and it's not a scalar. You need a scalar to write down the action. Right? So then you have to kill the indices somehow. And the way how you kill them is that you basically construct this index with that index, multiply by metric, and you kill the indices with metric, right? So if I have a tensor T alpha beta and I want to kill the indices, well, I just multiply it by G alpha beta, right? And that killed my index. So this is just T, right? So similarly, so you will multiply this with a you will construct this with that, and then you will multiply this with a matrix, with a metric, and then you get a Ricci scalar here. And that's what you have.
This thing was not working when we were taking L to be a function of G in DG because of principle of equivalence. But the moment we go to G, DG, and go to G, it works. It's not exactly related.
Sorry. So you have to include the second derivative here, right? Because there's no such object as just the first derivative. It will be just the metric, and that doesn't give you anything. Okay, so you need to include the second order metric, and this is just the simplest choice. Because of the principle of equivalence, this guy can always be made zero, and so that's why there is no such tensor which would contain that. Yes.
So the second derivative cannot be made zero just by free falling.
Yeah, that's okay. You will see with Lewis. So you will see that, you have sort of like coordinate freedom. I can always go to a freely falling frame. Coordinate freedom gives you, that many equations. You can kill that many things, right? You will see by explicit counting that you can always kill this thing here, but you cannot kill that thing over there. Okay, that one simply has too many components, and you don't have enough freedom to kill those components. What is remaining is 20 components you cannot kill. These are the number of components of the Riemann tensor. You cannot kill the Riemann tensor by doing a coordinate transformation. You will see that explicitly. Okay.
I didn't expect this, sorry. by coordinate transformations, you can get rid of the first derivative of the metric, but the Riemann will stay there. But that object depends on the dimension of your space, correct? Do you know what the, given the number of dimensions of your space, do you know what the way is to determine if that thing exists or not?
But it's complicated calculation. You would need to count the symmetries of this Riemann tensor, and then we'll give you some, restrictions on how many components it can have in, three dimensions, two dimensions, whatever. So in two dimensions, this thing here is topological. It doesn't have any degrees of freedom. In three dimensions, whatever. I don't remember. But yeah. So dependent on number of dimensions, this is either trivial or non-trivial. And then this has that many components, and gravity propagates more degrees of freedom, and so on.
Is the relationship that as we increase the number of dimensions, that thing gets more complicated, or is it something more?
It depends on what you want to do, right? But yes, gravity is much less restricted in higher dimensions. So it is wild in higher dimensions. Anything can basically happen, okay, in higher dimensions. So whereas, in two dimensions, there is no gravity at all. In three dimensions, if you are in vacuum, still no gravity. There is still no degrees of freedom. In 3+1 dimensions, another dimension, gravity is interesting, very interesting, but very restricted. You have lots of theorems, uniqueness theorems, lots of restrictions on what kind of solutions you can have, and so on. These are typically not true in higher dimensions. Okay, but anyway, this is not a course on gravity. I wanted to discuss nonlinear electrodynamics, but there's no time. So thank you so much for paying attention to my lectures, and yeah.
One more question.
Thank you.